Shame on you, says I, as we walk around a puddle and across the street. To talk that way, your own mother was a woman, or at least I suppose she was. And bad cess to her, says the one, the whoring old witch. The only part of me she ever liked to see was my bare bum covered with red stripes. She's burning in hell this moment, and I'm only sorry it wasn't me put her there, but a drunken sailor whose pocket she tried to pick, and who knocked her on the head with a bottle. Well, says the other, my own mother was an angel, to be sure. A saint on earth, according to her own reckoning, and would never let me forget it, and I don't know which is worse. I'm a philosopher, says the one. It's moderation for me, not too thin and not too fat, and best not to waste God's gifts to us, speaking of which, Grace, you're ripe enough to be picked. Why stay on the tree untasted? You'll just fall off and rot at the foot of it in any case. True enough, says the other. Why let the milk go sour in the bowl? A sweet nut should be cracked while there's still some goodness in it, as there's nothing worse than a fusty old nut. Come, you're making my mouth water for you already. You're enough to turn an honest man into a cannibal. I'd like to get a strong grip on you with my teeth, just what you might call a nibble, a small bite out of the ham end. You'd not miss it. You've enough on you and to spare. Right you are, says the one. Look, she's got a waist like a willow, but she's taking on fat below. It's all the fine cooking they do at the prison. Cream-fed she is. Would you just take a feel of it? That's a haunch fit for the Pope's own table. And he took to kneading and prodding, with the one hand that was hidden by the folds of my gown. I'll thank you not to take liberties, I say, pulling away. I'm all for liberties myself, says the one. Being a republican at heart, having no use for the Queen of England except what nature intended, and though she's got a fine pair of bosoms on her, and I'd pay her the compliment of giving them a squeeze at any time she might request it, she's got no chin to her at all, no more than a duck. And what I say is, no man is better than the next, and it's share and share alike and none preferred. And once you've given it out to one of us, why then, the others must all take their turns like true Democrats. And why should that little runt McDermott be allowed to enjoy what is denied to his betters? Yes, said the other. You gave him liberties enough, a fine time you had of it, I've no doubt, with him sweating away at it all night in the tavern in Lewiston, with barely a pause to refresh himself, for they say he was a prime athlete, and a dab hand with the axe as well, and could climb up a rope like a monkey. Right you are, said the other. And at last the cunning fellow tried to climb into heaven, and ended by making such a high leap into the air that he stayed up there for 2 hours, and could not be made to come down of his own accord, no matter how they called, but had to be fetched. And he danced while he was up there, a spry jig with the ropemaker's daughter, as lively as a rooster with its neck fresh wrung, so it did your heart good to see it. And stiff as a board he was afterwards, too, I'm told, said the one. But that's just what the ladies like. And here they laughed very much, and thought they'd made the finest joke in the world. But it was cruel in them to laugh at a man simply for being dead, and bad luck also, for the dead don't like being laughed at. And I assured myself that they had their own ways of protecting against injury, and would deal with the keepers in good time, either above the ground or beneath it. I spent the morning mending some blonde lace of Miss Lydia's that she'd torn at a party. She does tend to be careless about her clothes, and ought to be told that such fine clothes as hers are do not grow on trees. It was delicate work and a strain on the eyes, but I got it done at last. Dr. Jordan came as usual in the afternoon and seemed fatigued, and also troubled in mind. He hadn't brought any vegetable with him to ask me what I might think of it. And I was a little taken aback as I'd become used to this part of the afternoon, and had enjoyed wondering what he would bring next, and what it was he wanted me to say about it. So I said, "Sir, you are without any item today." And he said, "Item, Grace?" "Any potato or carrot," I said, "or onion or beet," I added. And he said, "Yes, Grace, I have determined upon a different plan." "What is that, sir?" I said. "I have decided to ask you what it is that you yourself would like me to bring." "Well, sir," I said, "that is indeed a different plan. I would have to consider it." and he said I was welcome to do that, and meanwhile, had I had any dreams? As he was looking for Lorne, and as it were at a loss, and as I suspected that not all was going well with him, I did not say that I could not remember. Instead, I said that I had indeed had a dream. "And what was it about?" said he, brightening up considerably and fiddling with his pencil. I told him I'd dreamt about flowers, and he wrote that down busily and asked what sort of flowers. I said that they were red flowers, and quite large, with glossy leaves like a peony. But I did not say that they were made of cloth, nor did I say when I had seen them last, nor did I say that they were not a dream. "And where were they growing?" said he. "Here," I said. "Here in this room?" said he, looking very alert. "No," I said, "outside in the yard where we take our walks for exercise." And he wrote that down as well. Or I suppose he wrote it down. I cannot be certain because I never see what he writes down, and sometimes I imagine that whatever he is writing down, it cannot possibly be anything that has come out of my mouth, as he does not understand much of what I say, although I try to put things as clearly as I can. It's as if he is deaf, and has not yet learned to read lips. But at other times he appears to understand quite well, although, like most gentlemen, he often wants a thing to mean more than it does. When he'd finished writing, I said, "I have thought of what I would like you to bring next time, sir." "And what is that, Grace?" said he. "A radish," I said. "A radish," he replied. "A red radish? And why have you chosen a radish?" And he frowned as if it was a matter for weighty thought. "Well, sir," said I, "the other things you have brought have not been for eating, or so it seemed, because most of them would need to be cooked first. And you took them away again with you, except for the apple you brought the first day, and very nice it was, too. But I thought that if you brought a radish, it could be eaten with no preparation, and they are now in season, and it is very seldom we get anything fresh in the penitentiary, and even when I eat in the kitchen of this house, I do not get such garden stuff as it is reserved for the family. So it would be a rare treat, and I would take it very kindly in you if you would bring a little salt as well." He gave a sort of sigh, and then he said, "Did they have radishes at Mr. Kinnear's?" "Oh, yes, sir," I said, "they did. But by the time I reached that place, they were past their prime, as a radish is best early in the season, for when the hot weather comes, they will go soft and maggoty and go to seed." He did not write this down. As he was preparing to leave, he said, "Thank you for telling me your dream, Grace. Perhaps you will tell me another one soon." And I said, "Perhaps I will, sir." And then I said, "I will try hard to remember them, if it will help you, sir, with the trouble you are in." For I was feeling pity towards him, he looked so out of sorts. And he said, "What makes you think I am in trouble, Grace?" And I said, "Those who have been in trouble themselves are alert to it in others, sir." He said it was a kind thought in me. Then he hesitated a moment as if to tell me more, but he thought better of it, and nodded goodbye. He always gives the same small nod when he goes out. I had not finished my quilting block for the day, as he had not been in the room with me as long as usual, and so I remained seated and continued to sew. After a short while, Miss Lydia came in. "Dr. Jordan has left?" she said. I said that he had. She was wearing a new dress which I helped sew, of a violet ground with a white design of small birds and flowers, very becoming to her, and a skirt on it like a half a pumpkin, and I thought she had most likely meant to have more of an audience for it than just myself. She sat down in the chair opposite me where Dr. Jordan had been sitting, and began to sort through the sewing basket. "I cannot find my thimble. I believe I put it in here," she said. "Then, oh, he has forgotten about the scissors. I thought he was not supposed to leave them within your reach." "We do not bother much about that," I said. "He knows I would not hurt him." She sat for a little while with the sewing basket in her lap. "Did you know you have an admirer, Grace?" she said. "Oh, who is that?" I said, thinking it would be a stable boy or some such young lad who might have heard my story and found it romantic. "Dr. Jerome DuPont," she said. "He is staying at present with Mrs. Quinnell. He says you have lived a remarkable life, and he finds you of considerable interest." "I do not know any such gentleman. I expect he reads the newspapers and is on a tour, and views me as a sight that must be seen, I said, a little sharply, for I suspected her of making fun of me. She is of a fun-loving nature, and sometimes goes too far with it. He is a man of serious pursuits, said she. He is studying neurohypnotism. What is that? I said. Oh, it is like mesmerism, but much more scientific, said she. It is all to do with the nerves. But he must know you, or at least he has seen you, as he says you are still quite handsome. Perhaps he passed you in the street as you are on your way here in the mornings. Perhaps, I said, thinking what a spectacle I made with a smirking ruffian to either side. He has such dark eyes, she said. They burn right into you, as if he could see inside. But I'm not sure I like him. Of course he's old. He's like Mama and the rest of them. I suppose he goes to their table rappings and seances. I don't believe in it, and neither does Dr. Jordan. Did he say so? I said. He is a man of sense, then. It's not a thing that should be meddled with. A man of sense? That is so cold, she said and sighed. A man of sense makes him sound like a banker. Then she said, Grace, he talks with you more than any of us put together. What sort of man is he, really? A gentleman, I said. Well, I knew that much, she said shortly. But what is he like? An American, I said, which was another thing she knew. Then I relented and said, he seems like a proper enough young man. Oh, I would not want him to be too proper, she said. Reverend Verringer is too proper. Privately, I agreed that this was so, but as Reverend Verringer is trying to get a pardon for me, I said, Reverend Verringer is a man of religion, and it is required of them to be proper. I think Dr. Jordan is very sarcastic, said Miss Lydia. Is he very sarcastic with you as well, Grace? I don't suppose I would know it if he was, miss, I said. She sighed again and said, He is going to address one of Mama's Tuesdays. I do not usually attend them, as it is so tedious, although Mama says I should take more interest in serious matters concerning the welfare of society, and Reverend Verringer says the same. But this time I will go, as I'm sure it will be thrilling to hear Dr. Jordan talk about asylums, though I would prefer him to invite me to tea in his chambers, with Mama and Marianne, of course, as I must have a chaperone. It is always advisable, I said, for a young girl. Grace, sometimes you are an old stick, she said, and I am no longer a young girl, really. I am 19. I suppose it's nothing to you. You've done all sorts of things, but I have never been to tea in a man's chambers before. Just because you've never done a thing before, miss, I said, is no good reason to do it. But if your mother would be going, I'm sure it would be respectable enough. She stood up and trailed her hand along the top of the sewing table. Yes, she said, it would be respectable enough. She appeared discouraged by this thought. Then she said, Will you help me with my new dress for the Tuesday circle, as I would like to make an impression with it? I said I would help her gladly. And she said I was a treasure, and she hoped they would never let me out of prison, as she would like me always to be there, to help her with the dresses, which I suppose was a compliment of a sort. But I did not like the drifting look in her eyes, or the falling note in her voice, and I thought, there will be trouble ahead, as is always the case when one loves and the other does not. On the next day, Dr. Jordan brings me the promised radish. It is washed, with the leaves cut off, and quite fresh and crisp, not rubbery the way they go when left to sit about. He's forgotten the salt, but I do not mention this, as it is not right to look a gift horse in the mouth. I eat the radish quickly. I've learned the habit of bolting my food in prison, as it must be eaten before it is snatched away. And I relish the sharpness of it, which is like the peppery smell of a nasturtium. I ask him how he came by it, and he says it is from the market, although he has a mind to make a small kitchen garden himself at the house where he lodges, as there is the place for it, and he has already begun the digging. Now, that is the thing I envy. Then I say, I thank you from the bottom of my heart, sir. This radish was like the nectar of the gods. He looks surprised to hear me use such an expression, but that's only because he doesn't remember that I have read the poetry of Sir Walter Scott. Because he was so thoughtful as to bring me this radish, I set to work willingly to tell my story, and to make it as interesting as I can and rich in incident, as a sort of return gift to him, for I have always believed that one good turn deserves another. When I left off last time, sir, I believe Mr. Kinnear had rode away to Toronto, and then Jamie Walsh came over and played his flute, and there was a lovely sunset. And then I went off to sleep with Nancy, as she was afraid of robbers with no man in the house. She did not count McDermott, as he did not sleep in the house itself, or perhaps she did not account him a man, or perhaps she thought he was more likely to side with the robbers and not against them. She did not say. So there we were, going up the staircase with our candles. Nancy's bedchamber, as I have said, was at the back of the house, and was much larger and finer than mine, although she had no separate dressing room like Mr. Kinnear's. But she had a commodious bedstead, with a fine quilt on it, a summer one in light pinks and blues on a white ground. It was a broken staircase. She had a wardrobe with her dresses in it, and I wondered how she could have saved up enough money to buy so many, but she said Mr. Kinnear was a generous master when the mood took him. Also, she had a dressing table with an embroidered runner on it, roses and lilies with the buds of each, and a sandalwood box with her earrings and a brooch, and also her pots of creams and potions were kept there, for before going to bed she greased the skin of her face like a boot. She had a bottle of rose water, too, and let me try some, which smelled most delicious, for on this evening she was all sociability, and a saucerful of hair pomade, which she rubbed in a little and said it gave the hair a shine, and she asked me to brush out her hair for her, just like a lady's maid, which I did with pleasure. She had lovely long hair, a dark brown and wavy. "Oh, Grace," she said, "that feels most luxurious. You have a good touch." And I was flattered. But I remembered Mary Whitney, and how she used to brush out my own hair, for indeed I had never forgotten her for long. "There we are, snug as two peas in a pod," she said, very friendly, when we were once in bed. But as she blew out the candle, she sighed, and it was not the sigh of a happy woman, but of one who is trying to make the best of things. Mr. Kinnear came back on the morning of the Saturday. He'd meant to return on the Friday, but had been delayed by business in Toronto, or so he said, and had stopped part of the way back at an inn which was not far north of the first toll gate, and Nancy was none too pleased to hear that, as the place had a bad reputation and was said to countenance loose women, or so she told me in the kitchen. I replied that a gentleman can stay at such places without any risk to his reputation, as I was trying to calm her. She was very agitated, because Mr. Kinnear had met with two of his acquaintances on the way home, Colonel Bridgeford and Captain Boyd, and had invited them to dine. And it was Jefferson the Butcher's day to come, but he had not yet done so, and there was no fresh meat in the house. "Oh, Grace," said Nancy, "we will have to kill a chicken. Just step out and request McDermott to do it." I said that surely we would need two chickens, as there would be six to dine with the ladies. But she was annoyed and said there would be no ladies, as the wives of these gentlemen never condescended to darken the door of the house, and she herself would not be taking dinner with them in the dining room, as all they would do was drink and smoke and tell stories about what fine deeds they'd done in the rebellion, and they would stay too long and play cards after, and it was bad for Mr. Kinnear's health, and he would catch a cough, as was always the case when these men came to visit. She allowed him a poor constitution when it suited her. When I went out to look for James McDermott, he was nowhere to be found. I called, and I even went so far as to go up the ladder into the loft over the stables where he slept. He was not there, but he had not run off, as his things were still in the loft, such as he had, and I didn't think he would go away without the pay that was owed him. As I came down the steps, there was Jamie Walsh, and he looked at me curiously, thinking, I suppose, that I'd been visiting McDermott. But when I asked where McDermott could have gone, as he was needed, Jamie Walsh smiled at me again and was friendly, and said he did not know, but that he might have gone across the road to Harvey's, who was a coarse fellow who lived in a log house, more like a shack, with a woman not his wife. I knew her by sight. Her name was Hannah Upton, and she had a rough look to her and was generally avoided. But Harvey was an acquaintance of McDermott, I won't say friend, and the two of them were in the habit of drinking together, and Jamie then said, was there any errands to be run? I went back into the kitchen and said McDermott could not be found, and Nancy said she'd had enough of his lazy ways. He was always going off when required and leaving her in the lurch, and I would have to kill the chicken myself. I said, oh, no, I could not do that. I'd never done it before and don't know how, as I had an aversion to shedding the blood of any living thing, although I could pluck a bird well enough once killed. And she said not to be a silly goose. It was easy enough. Just take the axe and knock it on the head and then give it a strong whack right through the neck. But I could not bear the thought of it and began to cry. And I am sorry to say, for it is wrong to speak ill of the dead, that she gave me a shake and a slap and pushed me out of the kitchen door into the courtyard and told me not to come back without a dead bird. And in a hurry, too, as we did not have much time to prepare, and Mr. Kinnear liked his meals on time. I went into the henyard and caught a plump young fowl, a white one, crying all the time, and tucked it securely under my arm and went towards the woodpile and the chopping block, wiping my tears with my apron, for I did not see how I could bring myself to do such a thing. But Jamie Walsh followed me and asked kindly what was the matter, and I said, could he please just kill the chicken for me? And he said there was nothing easier, and he would be glad to do so, as I was so squeamish and tender-hearted. So he took the bird from me and neatly chopped off its head, and it ran about with only a neck for a moment, and then lay kicking in the dirt, and I thought it was very pathetic. And then we plucked it together, sitting side by side on a rail of the fence, and making the feathers fly. And then I thanked him sincerely for his help, and said I did not have anything to give him for it, but would remember it for the future. And he grinned awkwardly and said he would help me willingly at any other time I might need it. Nancy had come out at the last part of this, and was standing at the kitchen door with her hand up to shade her eyes, waiting impatiently for the bird to be readied for cooking. So I cleaned it as fast as I could, holding my breath against the smell and keeping the giblets in case wanted for gravy, and rinsed it under the pump and brought it in. And she said in the kitchen as we were stuffing it, well, I see you have made a conquest. And I said, what did she mean? And she said, Jamie Walsh, he has a bad case of puppy love. It is written all over his face. He used to be my admirer, but now I see he is yours. And I saw she was trying to be friends with me again, after having lost her temper. So I laughed, and said he was not much of a catch for me, as he was only a boy, and with red hair like a carrot and freckled as an egg, too, although tall for his age. And she said, well, a worm will always turn, which I thought mysterious, but did not ask her what she meant in case she should think me ignorant. We had to get the stove good and hot in the summer kitchen to roast the chicken, so we did the rest of the work in the winter one. To be served with the chicken, we prepared a dish of creamed onions and carrots. And for the dessert there were strawberries, with our own cream, and our own cheese after. Mr. Kinnear kept the wine in the cellar, some in a barrel and some in bottles, and Nancy sent me down to bring up 5 bottles of it. She never did like going down there. She said there were too many spiders. In the midst of all our bustling, James McDermott sauntered in, as cool as you please, and when Nancy asked him where he'd got himself off to, using a warm tone of voice, he said that since he'd finished the morning's chores before he left, it was none of her damned business. And if she must know, he'd been on a special errand of Mr. Kinnear's, entrusted to him before Mr. Kinnear left for Toronto. And Nancy said she would see about that, and he had no right to come and go, and to vanish off the face of the earth just when he might be wanted most. And he said how was he to know? He could not read the future. And she said that if he could, he would see that he would not spend much more of it in this house. But as she was occupied at the moment, she would speak to him later. And just now he might look after Mr. Kinnear's horse, which was in need of grooming after the long ride, if he didn't consider such a thing too far beneath his Royal Highness. And he went off to the stables with a scowling face. Colonel Bridgeford and Captain Boyd arrived as promised, and behaved as Nancy said they would, and there were loud voices from the dining room and much laughter, and Nancy had me wait on table. She did not wish to do it herself, but sat in the kitchen and had a glass of wine, and poured one for me as well. And I thought she was resentful of these gentlemen. She said she did not think Captain Boyd was a real captain, as some of them had taken up such titles just for having got their two legs around a horse on the day of the rebellion. And I asked what about Mr. Kinnear, as some in the neighborhood called him captain as well. And she said she did not know about it, as he never styled himself in that manner, and his visiting card said plain Mister. However, if he had been a captain, it would certainly have been on the government side. And this was another thing she appeared to resent. She poured herself a second glass of wine, and said that Mr. Kinnear sometimes teased her about her name, and called her a fiery little rebel, because her last name was Montgomery, which was the same as John Montgomery, who'd owned the tavern where the rebels met together, and which was now a ruin. And he'd boasted that when his enemies were burning in hell, he would be keeping a tavern again on Young Street, which afterwards turned out to be true, sir, at least as to the tavern. But at that time he was still in the United States, having escaped in a daring manner from the Kingston Penitentiary. So it is a possible thing to be done. Nancy poured herself a third glass of wine, and said that she was getting too fat, and whatever would she do, and put her head down on her arms. But it was time for me to carry in the coffee, so I could not ask her why she had become so melancholy all of a sudden. In the dining room they were very merry, having consumed all five bottles, and called for more. And Captain Boyd said, where had Mr. Kinnear found me, and were there any more growing on that tree that I came from, and if so, were they ripe yet? And Colonel Bridgeford said, what had Tom Kinnear done with Nancy? Was she locked up in a cupboard somewhere with the rest of his Turkish harem? And Captain Boyd said I should look to my fine blue eyes, or Nancy might scratch them out if old Tom so much as winked at me sideways. It was all in fun, but still I hoped that Nancy had not heard. On the Sunday morning, Nancy said I should go to church with her. I said that I didn't have a good enough dress, though this was an excuse. I did not much want to go among strangers, where I would be sure to be stared at. But she said she would lend me a dress of hers, which she did, though she took care that it was one of her second best, and not so fine as what she herself put on. And she lent me a bonnet as well, and said I looked very proper. And also she let me wear a pair of her gloves, which did not, however, fit as they should, as Nancy had large hands. Also, we each wore a light shawl of patterned silk. Mr. Kinnear was nursing a headache, and said he would not go. He was never much of a churchman in any case, but said McDermott could drive us in the wagon and fetch us again later, it being understood that he would not attend the service, as he was a Catholic and the church was Presbyterian. It was the only church built there so far, and many who were not by rights members of that church attended, as being better than nothing. And it had the only graveyard in town as well, so held a monopoly of the dead as well as the living. We sat up in the wagon as fine as anything, and the day was bright and fair, with the birds singing, and I felt at peace with the world, as much as I ever did, which was fitting for the day. As we walked into the church, Nancy put her arm through mine, out of friendship, I believed. Some heads were turned, but I thought it was because I was new to them. There were all different sorts of people there, the poor farmers and their wives and servants, and the tradesmen of the town, as well as those who, from their dress and their positions in the front pews, thought themselves gentry, or next door to it. We sat on the benches at the back, which was the proper thing. The minister looked like a heron, with a pointed beak of a nose and a long, skinny neck and a tuft of hair sticking up from the top of his head. The sermon was on the subject of divine grace, and how we could be saved by it alone, and not through any efforts on our own part, or any good works we might do. But this did not mean we should stop making efforts, or doing good works. But we could not count on them, or be certain we had been saved, just because we were respected for our efforts in good works, because divine grace was a mystery, and the recipients of it were known to God alone. And although Scripture said that by their fruits you would know them, the fruits meant were spiritual fruits, and not visible to any but God alone. And although we must and should pray for divine grace, we should not be so puffed up with vanity as to believe that our prayers might have any effect, because man proposes, but God disposes, and it was not up to our puny, sinful, and mortal souls to determine the course of events. The first would be last, and the last would be first, and some that had been warming themselves by worldly fires for many years would soon find themselves roasting in something a good deal hotter, much to their indignation and surprise. And there were many whited sepulchres walking around in our midst, fair on the outside, but filled with rot and corruption within. And we should beware of the woman sitting at the door of her house, which Proverbs 9 warns of, or of any such who might tempt us by saying that stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant, because as Scripture tells, the dead are there, and her guests are in the depths of hell, and above all we should guard against complacency like the foolish virgins, and should not let our lamps go out, because no man knew the day and the hour thereof, and we must await in fear and trembling." He went on in this way for some time, and I found myself examining the bonnets of the ladies present, as much as I could see of them from the back, and the flowers on their shawls. And I said to myself that if you could not get divine grace by praying for it, or any other way, or ever know if you had it or not, then you might as well forget about the whole matter and go about your own business, because whether you would be damned or saved was no concern of yours. There is no use crying over spilt milk if you don't know whether the milk is spilt or not. And if God alone knew, then God alone could tidy it up if necessary. But thinking about such matters makes me drowsy, and the minister had a droning voice, and I was on the verge of nodding off, when we were all on our feet singing Abide With Me, which was not very well sung by the congregation, but at least it was music, which is always a consolation. Nancy and I were not greeted warmly by any as we went out, but rather avoided, although some of the poorer sort nodded. And there were whisperings as we went past, which I found odd, as although I was an unknown, Nancy herself must have been familiar to them. And though the gentry or those who fancied themselves such need not notice her, she did not deserve such treatment from the farmers and their wives, and from the others there who hired out as servants. Nancy held her head up high, and did not look to left or right, and I thought, these are cold and proud people and not good neighbors. They are hypocrites. They think the church is a cage to keep God in, so he will stay locked up there and not go wandering about the earth during the week, poking his nose into their business, and looking into the depths and darkness and doubleness of their hearts and their lack of true charity. And they believe they need only be bothered about him on Sundays when they have their best clothes on and their faces straight and their hands washed and their gloves on and their stories all prepared. But God is everywhere and cannot be caged in as men can. Nancy thanked me for going to church with her and said she'd been glad of the company. But she wanted me to give the dress and bonnet back that very day as she was concerned that they might get soiled. Later that week, McDermott came into the kitchen for the midday dinner with a long and sullen face. Nancy had given him his notice, and he was to leave at the end of the month. He said he was just as glad as he did not like being ordered about by a woman, and had never been thus while in the army or on the boats. But when he'd complained about it, Mr. Kinnear only said that Nancy was the mistress of the house and was paid to arrange things, and McDermott should take his orders from her, as Mr. Kinnear could not bother himself about trifling details. So that was bad. But it was much worse considering what type of woman she was, and he did not care to stay any longer with such a parcel of whores. I was shocked by this, and thought it was just McDermott's fashion and the way he talked and exaggerated and lied, and I asked him indignantly what he meant by that. And he said, did I not know that Nancy and Mr. Kinnear slept together, as bold as brass, and lived in secret as man and wife, though they were no more married than he was, although it was no secret, as all the neighborhood knew of it. I was much surprised and said so. And McDermott said I was an idiot, and despite my Mrs. Alderman Parkinson this and Mrs. Alderman Parkinson that and my city notions, I was not so knowing as I thought myself and could scarcely see the nose before my face. And as for the whorishness of Nancy, anyone but a simpleton such as me would have found it out at once, as it was only the common knowledge that Nancy had a baby when she was working over at Wright's by a young layabout who ran off and left her. Only the baby died. But Mr. Kinnear hired her and took her in anyway, which no respectable man would have done. And it was clear from the first what he'd had in mind, because once the horse was out of the stable, it was no good shutting the barn door, and a woman once on her back was like a turtle in the same plight. She could scarcely turn herself right side up again, and was fair game for all. Although I still protested, it came to me that for once he was telling the truth. And I saw in a flash the meaning of the averted heads at church and the whisperings, and also many other small things I had not taken much notice of, as well as the fine dresses and the gold earrings, which were the wages of sin, you might say, and even the warning of Mrs. Watson's cook, Sally, which was given to me before I had ever consented to be hired. After that, I kept my eyes and ears open, and went about the house like a spy, and made sure that Nancy's bed was never slept in when Mr. Kinnear was at home. And I was ashamed of myself for letting myself be tricked and imposed on in this fashion, and for being so blind and foolish. I am sorry to say that after this I lost much of the respect I'd once felt for Nancy, as being older and the mistress of the house, and I let my scorn show, and answered her back more than was wise. And there were arguments between us which came to raised voices, and on her side to a slap or two, for she had a quick temper and a flat hand. But I so far remembered my place as not to strike her back, and if I'd held my tongue, my ears would have rung less often. So I take some of the blame upon myself. Mr. Kinnear did not seem to notice the discord. If anything, he became kinder to me than before, and would stop beside me when I was at my various chores, and ask me how I was getting on. And I would always tell him, "Very well, sir," because there is nothing such a gentleman would wish to get rid of sooner than a discontented servant. You are paid to smile, and it does well to remember it. And he would tell me I was a good girl and a brisk worker. And once, when I was lugging a bucket of water up the stairs for Mr. Kinnear's bath, which he'd asked to be filled in his dressing room, he said, "Why was McDermott not doing that, as it was too heavy for me?" I said it was my task to do, and he wanted to take the bucket from me and carry it up himself, and put his hand over mine on the handle. "Oh, no, sir," said I, "I cannot allow it." And he laughed and said it was up to him what would be allowed or not, for he was master of the house, was he not? Which I had to say yes. And as we were standing thus close together on the stairs with his hand on mine, Nancy came into the downstairs hall and saw us, which did nothing to improve her disposition towards me. I have often thought that all would have gone better if there had been a separate staircase for the servants at the back of the house, as was usual, but there was none. And that meant we were all obliged to live too close together and in one another's pockets, which was not a desirable thing, as you could scarcely cough or laugh in that house without it being heard, especially from the downstairs hall. As for McDermott, he became more brooding and vengeful by the day, and he said that Nancy planned to turn him off before the month was up and to withhold his wages, but that he would not stand for it, and if she treated him so, she would soon treat me the same way, and that we should join together and demand our rights. And when Mr. Kinnear was away, and Nancy was visiting with her friends the Wrights, for they were among the neighbors who were still friendly towards her, he dipped more frequently into Mr. Kinnear's whiskey, which was bought by the keg, and thus in plentiful supply, and none to take account if some went missing. At these times he would say that he hated all Englishmen, and though Kinnear was a lowland Scot, it was the same thing. They were all thieves and whores, and stealers of land, and ground down the poor wherever they went, and both Mr. Kinnear and Nancy deserved to be knocked on the head and thrown down into the cellar, and he was the man for the deed. But I thought this was just a way of talking, as he was always a boaster, and saying what great things he would do. And my own father, when drunk, had often threatened to serve my mother in this way, but had never in fact done so. The best thing at such times was just to nod and agree with him, and to take no further notice. Dr. Jordan looks up from the notes he is making. "So you did not believe him at first?" he says. "Not at all, sir," I say. "Nor would you, if you yourself had been listening. I took it all for idle threats." "Before he was hanged, McDermott said that you were the one who put him up to it," says Dr. Jordan. "He claimed you intended to murder Nancy and Mr. Kinnear by putting poison into their porridge, and that you repeatedly urged him to help you, which he very piously refused to do." "Who told you such a lie?" I say. "It is written in McDermott's confession," says Dr. Jordan, "which I knew very well, having read the selfsame thing myself in the governor's wife's scrapbook." "Just because a thing has been written down, sir, does not mean it is God's truth," I say. He laughs his bark of a laugh, "Ha!" and tells me I am quite right about that. "All the same, Grace," he says, "what do you say to it?" "Well, sir," I say, "I think it is one of the silliest things I have ever heard." "Why is that, Grace?" says he. I allow myself to smile. "If I wanted to put poison into a bowl of porridge, sir, why would I have needed any help from such as him? I could have done it all by myself and put some in his own porridge, too, into the bargain. It would not take any more strength than the adding of a spoonful of sugar." "You are very cool about it, Grace," says Dr. Jordan. "Why do you think he said that about you if it was false?" "I suppose he wanted to shift the blame," I say slowly. "He never did like being put in the wrong, and perhaps he wanted me to keep him company on the journey. The road to death is a lonely highway, and longer than it appears, even when it leads straight down from the scaffold by way of a rope, and it's a dark road, with never any moon shining on it to light your way." "You seem to know a good deal about it, Grace, for one who has never been there," says he, with his uneven smile. "I have not been there," I say, "except in dreams. But I have looked along it many a night. I, too, was condemned to be hanged, and thought I would be. And it was only by luck and the skill of Mr. Mackenzie, who pleaded my extreme youth, that I got off. When you believe that you yourself are soon to go the same road, you must take your bearings of it." "True enough," says he, in a thoughtful voice. "Nor do I blame poor James McDermott," I say. "Not for such a wish. I would never blame a human creature for feeling lonely." The next Wednesday was my birthday. As things had cooled between Nancy and myself, I did not expect her to acknowledge it, although she knew the date well enough, as I told her my age when hired, and when I would turn 16. But, to my surprise, when she came into the kitchen in the morning, she was very friendly and wished me happy birthday, and went around to the front of the house herself and picked a little bouquet of roses from the trellises there and put them into a glass for me to have in my room. And I was so grateful for the kindness from her, which was rare enough by that time, what with our quarreling, that I almost cried. Then she said I could have the afternoon free, as it was my birthday. And I thanked her very much, but I said I wouldn't know what to do with myself, as I had no friends in the neighborhood to visit, and there were no real shops and nothing to see, and perhaps I should just stay at home and sew, or clean the silver, as I'd been planning to do. And she said I could stroll into the village if I liked, or go for a pleasant walk in the countryside around, and I could borrow her straw hat. But later I learned that Mr. Kinnear intended to be at home all that afternoon, and I suspected that Nancy wanted me out of the way so she could spend time with him alone without worrying about whether I would come suddenly into the room or up the stairs, or whether Mr. Kinnear would wander back into the kitchen where I was and hang about there asking this and that, as he had been tending to do of late. However, after I'd taken in the dinner for Mr. Kinnear and Nancy, which was cold roast beef and a salad as the weather was hot, and had eaten my own dinner with McDermott in the winter kitchen, and had cleaned up the dishes and washed my hands and face, I took off my apron and hung it up, and put on Nancy's straw hat and my white and blue kerchief for keeping the sun off the neck, and McDermott, who was still sitting at the table, asked where I was going. And I said it was my birthday, and therefore Nancy had given me leave to go out for a walk. He said he would come with me, as there were many rough men and vagabonds on the road that I needed protection from. It was on the tip of my tongue to say that the only one such I knew of was sitting right there in the kitchen with me, but as McDermott had made an effort to be civil, I bit my tongue and thanked him for his kind thoughts, but said it was not required. He said he would come in any case, as I was young and flighty and did not know what was good for me, and I said it was not his birthday, and he had the chores to do, and he said birthday be damned. He did not give a pin for birthdays, and he saw it as no cause for celebration, as he was not overly thankful to his mother for having given birth to him, and even if it was his birthday, Nancy would never give him any time off for it. And I said he should not begrudge it to me, as I had not asked for it and wanted no special favors. And I left the kitchen as soon as I could. I had no idea in my mind of where I should go. I did not want to walk into the main part of the village, where there was no one I knew, and it struck me at once how very solitary I was, as I had no friends here except Nancy, if she could be called a friend, being such a weather vane, a friend one day and the next one quite turned against me, and perhaps Jamie Walsh. But he was a mere boy. There was Charlie, but he was a horse, and although a good listener and a comfort of not much avail when I needed advice. I did not know where my family was, which was the same as having none. Not that I ever wished to see my father again, but I would have been glad of some news of the children. There was Aunt Pauline, and I could have written her a letter if I'd been able to afford the postage, for this was before the reforms, and to send a letter far across the sea was very expensive. I was indeed alone in the world, with no prospects before me except the drudgery I'd been doing, and although I could always find a different situation, still it would be the same sort of work, from dawn to dusk, with always a mistress to be ordering me about. So thinking, I walked down the driveway, keeping up a brisk enough pace while McDermott might be watching, and indeed when I turned once, there he was, leaning in the kitchen doorway. For if I loitered, he might take it as an invitation to join me. But when I reached the orchard, I thought myself out of sight and slowed down. I usually kept a firm enough grip on my feelings. Yet there is something depressing to the spirits about a birthday, especially when alone. And I turned into the orchard and sat down with my back against one of the big old stumps that were left over from the forest when it was cleared. The birds were singing around me, but I reflected that the very birds were strangers to me, for I did not even know their names. And that seemed to me the saddest of all, and the tears began to roll down my cheeks. And I did not dry them, but indulged myself in weeping for several minutes. But then, I said to myself, what can't be cured must be endured. And I looked around at the white daisies and the Queen Anne's lace, and at the purple globes of the milkweed flowers which smelled so sweetly and were covered with orange butterflies. And then I looked up at the branches of the apple tree above me, where the small green apples were already forming, and at the patches of blue sky visible beyond, and attempted to cheer myself up by reflecting that only a benevolent God, who had our good at heart, would have created so much beauty, and that whatever burdens were laid upon me were surely trials, to test my strength and faith, as with the early Christians, and Job, and the martyrs. But, as I have said, thoughts about God often make me drowsy, and I fell asleep. It is a strange thing, but however deeply asleep I may be, I can always sense when there is a person come close, or watching me. It is as if there is a part of me that never sleeps at all, but keeps one eye a little open. And when I was younger, I used to think this was my guardian angel. But perhaps it comes from my early days, when to sleep past my time for getting up and starting the work of the house would be the occasion for shouts on the part of my father and harsh words, and I would find myself hauled out asleep by one arm, or else by the hair. In any case, I was dreaming that a bear had come out of the forest and was looking at me. Then I woke with a start, just as if a hand had been laid on me, and there was a man standing quite near, against the sun, so I couldn't see his face. I gave a little shriek and began to scramble up. But then I saw it was not a man, but only Jamie Walsh, and I remained where I was. "Oh, Jamie," I said, "you startled me." "I didn't mean to," he said. And he sat down beside me under the tree. Then he said, "What are you doing here in the middle of the day? Won't Nancy be after you?" For he was a very inquisitive boy and was always asking questions. I explained about my birthday and said it was kind of Nancy to give me the entire afternoon to myself, and he wished me a happy birthday. Then he said, "I saw you crying." And I said, "Where were you to be spying on me like that?" He said he often came into the orchard when Mr. Kinnear wasn't looking, and later in the season Mr. Kinnear sometimes stood on the veranda and used his telescope to make sure the boys around were not robbing his orchard, but the apples and pears were still too green for that. Then he said, "Why are you sad, Grace?" I felt I would cry again and said simply, "I have no friends here." Jamie said, "I am your friend." And then he paused and said, "Do you have a sweetheart, Grace?" And I said I did not. And he said, "I would like to be your sweetheart. And in a few years, when I'm older and have saved the money for it, we will be married." I could not keep myself from smiling at that. I said, making a joke of it, "But are you not in love with Nancy?" And he said, "No, though I like her well enough." Then he said, "So what do you say to it?" "But Jamie," I said, "I am a great deal older than you," and I spoke as if teasing, for I could not believe he was in earnest. "A year and a bit," he said. "A year is nothing." "Still, you are only a boy," I said. "I am taller than you," he said, which was true. "But I don't know why it is. A girl of 15 or 16 is accounted a woman, but a boy of 15 or 16 is still a boy." I did not say this, however, seeing it was a sore point with him. So I thanked him gravely for his offer and told him I would consider it, as I did not wish to hurt his feelings. "Come," he said, "as it is your birthday, I will play you a tune." And he took out his fife and played "The Soldier Boy to the Wars Has Gone," very nicely and with feeling, although a trifle shrill on the top notes. And then he played "Believe Me If All These Endearing Young Charms." And I could tell that these must have been some new pieces that he was practicing, and he was proud of them. So I told him how lovely it was. After that, he said he would make me a daisy crown in honor of the day, and the two of us set to making daisy chains and were very busy and industrious over them, just like small children. And I don't think I'd enjoyed myself more since the times with Mary Whitney. When we were finished, he very solemnly put one chain around my hat and another around my neck for a necklace, and said I was the May Queen, and I said I would have to be the July Queen, as it was July, and we laughed. And he asked if he could give me a kiss on the cheek, which I said yes, but only one. And he did it. And I told him that he had made my birthday a fine occasion after all, because he'd taken my mind off all of my worries, and he smiled at that. But the time had gone flying by, and the afternoon was now over. As I came back up the drive, I saw Mr. Kinnear standing on the veranda and looking at me with his telescope. And as I approached the back door, he walked around the side of the house and said, "Good afternoon, Grace." I returned it, and he said, "Who was that man with you in the orchard, and what were you doing with him?" I could hear in his voice what sort of suspicions he was entertaining, and I said it was only young Jamie Walsh, and we were making daisy chains because it was my birthday. And he accepted that, but was none too pleased all the same. And when I went into the kitchen to begin the preparations for supper, Nancy said, "What is that wilted flower doing in your hair? It looks very silly." There was one, which had got caught when I was taking off the daisy necklace. But these two things together took some of the innocence out of the day. So I set about cooking the supper, and when McDermott came in later with an armful of wood for the stove, he said in a sneering manner, "So you were rolling about in the grass and kissing the errand boy. He should have his brains knocked out for that, and I'd do it for him myself if he wasn't such a baby. It's clear you prefer the boys to the men, such a fine cradle robber you are." And I said I was doing no such thing, but he did not believe me. I felt as though my afternoon had not been mine at all, and not a kind and private thing, but had been spied upon by every one of them, with Mr. Kinnear included, which I did not think he would have stooped so low, exactly as if they'd all been lined up in a row at the door of my chamber, and taking turns at looking through the keyhole, which made me very sad, and also angry. I was in the kitchen garden picking the new peas and turning the anger over in my mind, for I was still angry over the suspicions and prying I had been subject to, as well as McDermott's bitter teasing, when I heard a tuneful whistling, and I saw a man coming up the drive with a pack on his back and a weather-beaten hat on his head and a long walking stick in his hand. It was Jeremiah, the peddler. I was so glad to see a face from better times that I dropped the peas out of my apron in a heap on the ground and waved and ran down the drive to meet him. For he was an old friend, or so I thought of him by then. In a new country, friends become old friends very quickly. "Well, Grace," he said, "I told you I would come." "And I am very glad to see you, Jeremiah," I said. I walked with him to the back door of the house and said, "What do you have with you today?" For I always love to see the contents of a peddler's pack, even if most of the things were beyond my means. He said, "Aren't you going to invite me into the kitchen, Grace, out of the sun where it is cool?" And I remembered that this was the way it was done at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, and I did so. And once he was inside, I sat him down at the kitchen table and got him some small beer from the pantry, and a cup of cold water, and I cut him a slice of bread and cheese. I was quite the busybody, as I felt that he was a guest of a kind, and I was by way of being the hostess, and so should do the hospitable thing. And I had a glass of beer, too, to keep him company. "Here's to your good health, Grace," he said. I thanked him and returned it. "And are you happy here?" he said. "The house is a very beautiful one," I said, "with pictures and a piano." For I did not like to speak ill of anyone, and especially not my master and mistress. "But in a quiet and removed situation," he said, regarding me with his bright and shining eyes. He had eyes like blackberries, and an air of being able to see more than most could. And I could tell he was trying to look into my mind, but in a kindly way, for I believe he always had a regard for me. "It is quiet," I said, "but Mr. Kinnear is a liberal gentleman." "And with a gentleman's tastes," he said, giving me a shrewd look. "They say in the neighborhood he has a hankering after the servant girls, especially those close to home. I hope you will not end up like Mary Whitney." I was startled at that, for I thought I was the only one to know the truth about that affair, and which gentleman it was, and how close to home, and I'd never told a living soul. "How did you guess it?" I said. He put his finger alongside his nose to signify silence and wisdom, and said, "The future lies hid in the present for those that can read it." And since he already knew so much, I unburdened myself to him, and told him everything I have told you, sir, even the part where I heard Mary's voice, and fainted, and ran about the house with no recollection of it, except about the doctor, as I felt Mary would not want it known. But I believe Jeremiah guessed about it, for he was a great man for divining what was meant, even when not spoken out loud. "That is a sad story," said Jeremiah, when I had done. As for you, Grace, a stitch in time saves nine. You know that Nancy was the servant of the house not so long ago and did all the rough and dirty work that you do now. That was very direct, and I looked down. I did not know that, I said. Once a man gets a habit, it is hard to break.